All right, we're going to start here on the top of Tzadit Amud Aleph, but the first line. Gemara says, Tan Rabbanan, continuing just to give a little more information about the covers that were on top of the Mishkan. Remember that the lower cover was called the Yiriyata Mishkan, was the cover of the Mishkan, and the one above it was called Yiriyata Ohel, because it went on top of the Yiriyata Mishkan. So now the Gemara says, Yiriyata Tachtonot, the lower curtains or covers, were made up of Shel Tchelet, Vishel Argaman, Vishel Tolat Shani, Vishel Shesh. They were made up of these materials. Tchelet Argaman and Tolat Shani are wool dyed of those colors, blue, purple, and red. And then Shesh is linen. Ve'el Yonot, the upper coverings, Shel Ma'asei Zim, were made out of goat's hair. Gudolach Achma, Shenemra Be'el Yonot, Miter Mima Shenemra B'tachtonot. Took a lot more wisdom or craftsmanship to make the upper covers than the lower covers. Because dealing with tachtonot by the lower covers, the Yiriyata Mishkan, it says, V'chol isha chokhmat lev biyadea tavu. Any woman that had that wisdom was able to work with her hands in order to spin it. V'ilu bel yonot k'tiv, on the upper covers, the Yiriyata Izim, over there it's written, V'chol anashim asher nasa liban otano bechokhma, not only the chokhma, but the nisiat liban, and then tavu et ha'izim, they spun the goats. V'tanyo, and we learn in a Braita, Mishum, Rabbi Nechemia, Shituv Izim, V'tavui Min Izim, that they were washed off, cleansed off on the goats themselves, and then spun directly from the goats. They did not cut it off first, or remove it first, and then spin it, but they spun it directly off the goats. And that took exceptional wisdom or craftsmanship, and that's why the Yiriyata Izim took more effort, work, wisdom, craftsmanship to make than the Yiriyata Mishkan. Shtei Guzdarot, we saw this in the Mishnah, if you have these two projectiles that are sticking out to where the Rishut HaRabim. Amarav Mishum Rabbi Chia. Agalot, Tachtehem, Uvenehem, Vitzidehem, Mirshut HaRabim. So we saw this yesterday, this statement of Rav in the name of Rabbi Chia, that the Agalot, below them, next to them, and then between them, are classified as Rishut HaRabim. Amaravaye, Fein Agala, Le'Agala, Lo Orech Agala. Between each of the wagons, you have a space that is equivalent to the length of the agalot. V'kama orech agala. How long was an agala? Hey amot. 5 amot. We saw this already yesterday that the agalot were 5 amot long. And over here it says that the space between the agalot is the equivalent to the length of the agala. What it's not clear here is where was that space. According to Rashi, it was in between the two agalot from side to side. So even though here we're dealing with length of the agalot, we're still explaining the amount of space between the sides of the agalot. And we saw that yesterday, again, the way the agalot were lined up, that you had the agalot themselves were 2.5 amot, then their wheels and axle space on the side was 2.5 amot, so that got you 5 amot, and then there was another 2.5 amot to its side, and then another 2.5 amot for the next agala, and then 2.5 for its wheels, and then 2.5 for its body. So there was 5 amot that sat between the agalot, according to Rashi. Here it's describing the rochav. The width between the agalot was equivalent to the length of the agalot. So here the length of the agalot is 5 amot. Then that space between them was 5 amot, according to Rashi. Tosafot says it's a siman ba'alma, that there's nothing special about this. It's just telling us that the orech of the agalot was 5 amot. The other possibility is that they were one in front of the other. And here the Gemara is telling you that they are 5 amot apart when they're sitting one in front of the other. Then the Gemara says, hey amot, lomali, why do I need there's 5 amot? V'dalad upalgo sagi. 4.5 amot would have been sufficient. When we saw this yesterday, when we stacked up the agalot with the prashim on top of them, according to Rashi, there were two possible ways of stacking them up. Now, you can either stack them up 1.5 amot on their sides, or you can put them up on their depth and put them 1 amot at a time. Either way, you would have been sufficient either with 4.5 if you put them on their width, because they're 1.5 amot each, you can only put 3 of them there for a total of 4.5 amot. Or if you put them up on their depth side, on the 1 amot side, then you only need 4 amot. So why do you need the full 5 amot to put the krashim down? There should have been sufficient for the orech, for the length of the wagon to be 4.5 amot. Keheche delo didachu krashim, in order that the krashim should not bang up against each other. If he wants to put them al rachban, Rashi says, you want to place them on the rochav, that they should have some space to work between them. So Rashi suggests over here that they were laying on their 1.5 amot side. In order to not bang up against each other, you need a little space there. You can't just have them up against each other. Tosafot does not like Rashi's explanation for a couple of reasons, one of which Rashi is saying that the Gemara here concludes that they had them on their side, on their width, 1.5 amah, 1.5 amah. when yesterday the Gemara already concluded that it wasn't the case, that they were sitting al chodan, that they were sitting on the one amasai, they were sitting on their depth. In order to get sufficient space between them, we needed them to sit on their one amasai and then leave the gap in the middle in order to explain the statement of Rav that there was Rishut HaRabim around the agalot, and it was not considered to be Rishut HaRabim Mikureh. So because of that, we already said yesterday that they were sitting on their sides. So Tosfos says, Nira Lefaresh, Lo Dachuku Akrashim, Dafagav, the Daya Bar Bevechetzi. Ein Ochanami, it would have been enough with 4.5, or really, here, according to Tosafot's position, it would have been enough with 4. Dai Bechav Bevechetzi, the Tabot Shehen, Zukenegetzu, Vaya Shem Advek, the Faresh Shein Galush, Yikomakom, Bnei Kovdan. Because of the weight of the Krashim, they shift around and they bang up against each other. Unless there's a greater space between them. So even though it would have been sufficient with 4.5 in order to do this, meaning if you stack them up al chudan, you have 4 amot, and even with little spacing in between them for the tabaot, it would have been sufficient to press them up together at 4.5. Despite that fact, we gave an extra half a ma because these boards were extremely large, extremely heavy. And they're going to bounce around and shift a little bit. You have to give some space so that they don't topple over or they don't bump up against each other. So then the Gemara says, "V'kama rocha v'agala." What is the width of an agala? The shtei amot u'mechza. It's 2.5 amot wide. V'lamali. Why do I need that? V'amto palgas agia. Again, it would be enough to have 1.5 amot on the width. Rashi suggests over here, well, why would it be enough to have 1.5 on the width? Because you might think about placing the krashim, not along the, right now what we have is the length of the krashim is across the width of the agala. Place the krashim across this way, across there. But what happens if you wanted to put them lengthwise into the agala? The agala was simply 1.5 wide. You could stick the kerish in there because the krashim themselves were 1.5 wide. And then it would fit into the wagon in that way. So that's what Rashi suggests that the Gemara's question is. You don't need this 2.5 wide. We can just stick the krashim in it. You could push it in with 1.5 and you'd be fine. So Rashi says in the end, the reason that they didn't keep it that narrow is because if they're putting the length of the krashim across the width of the agala, if it was so narrow, if it was 1.5 wide, then the boards would not balance on the agala. They would shift from side to side. They would topple over. So you need a wide enough base in the center of the agala in order to support the krashim that are going across. That's the way Rashi reads it. Tosafot doesn't like the answer at all because he doesn't understand the question at all. He says these boards were so heavy. And how could you ever suggest that these boards would sit on 2.5 amot wide? Even if you say it's 2.5 amot wide, how could you suggest that they would sit on that area? And now the Gemara asks, forget about 2.5 wide, put them on 1.5 wide. According to the way Rashi is learning, he doesn't understand the question of the Gemara, he doesn't understand the conclusion of the Gemara. And number two is, this is what Rocky asked yesterday, if you have the two agalot going next to each other, it sounds like from the Gemara that there's 15 amot across, it sounds like the krashim are right up against each other. There's no space between them. It's also very difficult. So because of that, the Reino Tam says that actually this was a double wagon. The two agalot were actually attached to each other. And that there was one axle that ran across for both of the wagons. And it was a side-by-side double wagon. Because then you get a huge expanse across that allows you to put the krashim on. And it would be well balanced on the two agalot, if they were right up against each other. So then, what's the question of the Gemara? He says, despite the fact that they were against each other, the Gemara thought that 1.5 amot would be sufficient then. If you have the two agalot together, then you don't need them to be 2.5 wide each. You could have them be 1.5 wide. Nevertheless, the Gemara says, no, because they could still flop over. If you had them only 1.5 wide and the two agalot were together, it still would not be balanced enough to give it a broad base in order that it doesn't come imbalanced. So the Rabbeinu Tam rejects Rashi's understanding of the whole, basically the whole Gemara all the way along about how they played laid the krashim out because says that the weight of these krashim is so great and the narrowness of the agalot don't make sense that they were piling up krashim on it. The Gemara says, Ella de Haimelon der Rishut HaRabim Sheshes Reyama. So then, how do we know that Rishut HaRabim is 16 amot wide? Anan de Gamrinan la Mishkan. We learned that out of the Mishkan. Mishkan, how is it possible that we learned that Rishut HaRabim is 16 amot wide, and we're learning from the Mishkan, but the Mishkan, you only have 15 amot across. Because the agalot themselves are 5 amot, and then you have 5 amot between them. That gets you a span of 15 amot. So Rashi asks the obvious question, which is, what do you mean 15 amot? You really have 20 amot here across. You have a stretch of 20 amot, because if you put up the two krashim against each other, the krashim themselves are 10 amot, they extend 5 amot out on each side. So it's really a span of 20 amot, not a span of 15 amot. So Rashi says, "Legabei reshut rabin leitlan the mikshav ala makom agalot v'revach shibneihem." We only count the space of the agalot and what's between them. Shulam matam yud, because that's below 10 tefachim. To call them malam yud, anything above 10 tefachim, lav reshut rabim hi. That's not classified as reshut rabim. So the krashim that stick out on the outside, we know we're above 10 tefachim. So that area we're not going to count at all. The agalot, we are going to count because they sit below 10 tefachim. You know, they raise the krashim above 10 tefachim. They themselves sit below the 10 tefachim, and then they have the space between them is enclosed by them. Even though over there, the krashim are above 10 tefachim. So that's why Rashi says we only count the 15 middle amot, not the outer 5 amot, 2.5 amot on each side, because they're outside of the area of the agalot, which are below 10 tefachim. The wagons, including the wheel area, are 5 amot wide. So you have two of those wagons of 5 amot wide, including their wheels, and 5 amot in the middle. So that gives you a span of 15 amot. The krashim still stick out on each side, 2.5 amot. Those 2.5 amot, Rashi says, we don't count because they're above 10 tefachim. So then the Gemara says, "Dahava kai ben Levi." There was a ben Levi that walked between them. That in case the krashim shifted, he'd be able to put them back on. So truthfully, each wagon itself only took up 5 amot. Between them was 5 amot, that would have been 15 amot. The Gemara is suggesting over here is that they split apart. They moved the wagons apart in Amah to leave space over here between the Krashim, so that a Ben Levi could walk between the two wagons. So the space in between them actually was not 5 amot, but really 6 amot, because they had the 2.5 amot that the board stuck over, plus an extra Amah in between them that the individual Levi stood. And we see other places in Chas that the width of an individual is an Amah. First of all, in the mikveh, the Gemara says that a person can enter into a mikveh that's an amah by 3 amot deep. In other places, when they made the kuchim to bury people in, they also made them 1 amah wide. So their understanding was that a person's width, that the general width of a person is an amah. Rashi over here actually says that they had 2 b'nei Levi that stood there, and they squeezed themselves in, that he pushed himself in, if he needed to get in there, in a half amah that was between them to slide into the gap we saw here between them, the gapping between them. If he wanted to squeeze himself in there, he would slide in between and then climb into that area in order to straighten out the boards. Either way, we needed a little extra space, because that extra space, that's how we get the span of Reshut HaRabim being 16 amot and not the 15 amot that would have been taken up by the agalot. Again, according to Rashi, it's a little bit more difficult because Rashi has them as two separate agalot. And as Rashi asked yesterday, then there's no space in between them. According to Reino Tam, since they're all connected, there's a single axle that's 15 amot long with 4 wheels on them, you could put the krashim up against each other because there was no separation between them. They ran as a single unit. And then the Gemara answers, well, we need some space. We need spacing for the Ben Levi to get in there. So either according to Rashi, they separated the Agalot a little bit from each other, or according to the Rabbeinu Tam, an Amah longer in order to allow for that span. All right, next Mishnah. Kliyata bor vasela, shein gvoyim asara, v'rachban arba'a, notel mehen, v'noten al-gaban chayav, chod mekein patur. So if you have a sela, sela is height, bedrock that goes up. Bor is a pit, a cistern that is in the Reshut HaRabim. Chuliyata bor is the walls of the bor, but chuliyah is usually what you dig out of the bor. The dirt that's excavated from digging the cistern or the bor, you place that around the edge of the bor, and that creates a chuliyah, a rim around the bor that's going up. Over here you have two things that sound like they are height-wise, which is either sela, bedrock that rises, or something that's solid that rises in the Reshut HaRabim. If it's 10 tefachim high and 4 tefachim wide, 4 by 4 tefachim wide, then it's classified as a reshut yachid. Once it's classified as a reshut yachid, if you take from it or place on it, then you are going to be chayav. Gemara says that's true by the bedrock. It's also true by the dirt piled up around the bor. Gemara says, lamali the mitnei chuliyat habor vasela. Why do I have to say the chuliyat habor and the sela? Litnei habor vasela. Why don't I just say the bor and the sela? What does the chuliyah do for me over here? I would have understood it if you told me bor and sela. Bor would mean going down, and sela would mean going up. And what the Mishnah is teaching you is it doesn't matter for Reshut HaYachid whether the ten fachim are rising out of the Reshut HaRabim or descending from the Reshut HaRabim. If you have a pit that is 10 fachim deep and 4 by 4 wide, that's also Reshut HaYachid. If it ascends from the Reshut HaRabim, you have an area that's higher than the Reshut HaRabim, that's 4 by 4 or 10 high, that's Reshut HaYachid. So I would have understood if you broke up the Mishnah into Sela and Bor, why you did that. What I don't understand here is, you gave me two items in the Mishnah that are both rising up from the ground. One is the Sela, the bedrock that comes up, and then you told me about the Chuliyat HaBor, which is the rim around the Bor, or the dirt piled up around the Bor, that's also ascending out of the Reshut HaRabim. So why do you have to tell me twice about something that ascends off the ground that that's classified as a Rishut HaYachid? Where it says, Misayle the Rabbi Yochanan. Our Mishnah supports a statement that we know from Rabbi Yochanan, Dam Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan says, Bor v'chulyata mitzarfim le'asara. The bor itself, pit itself, and the rim around it can join together to get you the 10 tefachim. So for instance, if you excavate into the ground 5 tefachim, and the dirt that you removed, you now pile around the rim, up high, a rim that is now 5 tefachim high. So the combination of the pit, 5 tefachim down, and the chuliyah, the rim above it, which is 5 tefachim high, can add together to make up the 10 tefachim. So that's what the Mishnah came to teach us, agav. As a sidebar, the Mishnah taught us, not only are you chayav when you rise 10 tefachim out of the Rishut HaYachid, not only when you descend 10 tefachim out of the Rishut HaBim, are you classified as Rishut HaYachid, but if you have a combination, you have a combination of depth as well as height in the Rishut HaRabim, those two can combine together to create the 10 tefachim that you need. Tanya Nami Hochi, we have a brayta that supports that understanding. Bor Rishut HaRabim, Amuka Yud. If you have a pit or cistern in the Rishut HaRabim that is 10 tefachim deep, Rechva Arba'a, and it's 4x4 tefachim, Ein Mimalim Heimenu B'Shabbat. One cannot then draw water from it on Shabbat. If it's in the Rishut HaRabim, one may not draw water from it on Shabbat. Elim Ken Asula Mechitza Boa Yud Tefachim. Unless you build around it a fence, or some sort of mechitza that is 10 tefachim high in order to make it a Rishut HaYachid around it. So thereby, when you draw out the water from the cistern, then you're bringing it from a Rishut HaYachid into a Rishut HaYachid, which would be permissible on Shabbat. Ve'en shotim emenu b'Shabbat. You can't lean over and drink from it on Shabbat. Elim ken ichnis la rosho v'rubo. Unless your head and the majority of your body is inside the bor or over the cistern. Because our fear is, the Gemara discusses what the different reasons might be. One of the reasons the Gemara says, oh, because you're drinking the water, and the water is moving from a Rishut HaYachid to a Rishut HaRabim, if your body's in a Rishut HaRabim. The Gemara later rejects that and says that what we're fearful of is that you're going to actually take the water back with you into the Rishut HaRabim. If you lean over to start to drink, we're afraid that you're going to come back with the water and take it out of the Rishut HaYachid to the Rishut HaRabim. So once your Rosh and Rov of your body's inside that Rishut HaYachid or leaning over the bor, then we're no longer fearful because you're going to drink where you are. You're not going to bring the water back. And the part that we're after in the bright over here is bor v'chuliyata mitztarfim la'asara. Pit, or the cistern itself, and its rim around it are mitzareif. They join together to create the 10 tefachim. That's the same statement that we saw from Rabbi Yochanan, as well as what we're trying to infer from our Mishnah, the fact that our Mishnah did not say that it was Sela and Bor, but rather said Sela v'chuliyata Bor. It's teaching us this lesson, that the 10 tefachim can be a combination of the Bor and its chuliyah. Now, the Gemara in Erevin is full of these, what we call pasim, ways to create a quasi-private domain around a water source in order that people could go to these water sources and draw on Shabbat. There you don't need full-fledged mechitzot. You don't need 10 tefachim mechitzot around it to make it into Rishut HaYachid. There's a dispensation to make wider areas or special pasim, they call boards. You see this a lot in Erevin when I get to it, that created that Rishut HaYachid or area around it. So Tosafot asks over here, how come over here the Breita doesn't let you do that? He says that dispensation was only given for Be'er Mayim Chayim, a live water source, or for Bor HaRabim, it's a public cistern. Over here we're talking about a private cistern. For a private cistern, there aren't these dispensations to put up the pasim. You actually have to build a real mechitza around it in order that it's a Rishut HaYachid, the area where you're going to draw the water from, so that when you draw it out, you're still in a Rishut HaYachid. Rav Mordechai asked this question of Rava. And others have the girsa of Rabba. Amud b'Rishut HaRabim gvoa yud v'rachav dalet. You have a pole that is in the Rishut HaRabim, standing up 10 tefachim high and 4x4 tefachim wide. So that is what we call a Rishut HaYachid. Vizarak, and he throws it. V'nach al gabav, and the object lands on top of it. Mahu, what's the din? Mi amrina nareya kira bisur v'areya nacha bisur. He's throwing it from the Rishut HaRabim, so he has an akira from a place that is problematic, and then it lands on this pole pillar that is standing there that is classified as a Rishut HaYachid, and therefore you have hanachah b'isur. It landed in a place that is asur. So you left a place that is asur and landed in a place that is asur. You went from Rishut HaRabim to Rishut HaYachid. So therefore you should be chayav. Or, Dilma came into Makom Patur Ka'acha, lo. Maybe because it had to pass through a Makom Patur to get there, you should not be chayav. Because we know that the Rishut HaRabim ends. The height of Rishut HaRabim is over at 10 tefachim. In order to get an object from the Rishut HaRabim to a pole in the Rishut HaRabim that's 10 tefachim high, you would have to exit the Rishut HaRabim, go into the Makom Patur, and then land on the pillar that is classified as a Rishut HaYachid. So you have an object that is going from Rishut HaRabim through the Makom Patur and then landing on the Rishut HaYachid. So what is the din here? Is it considered to be that we're directly carrying it from the Rishut HaRabim to the Rishut HaYachid, therefore he's Chayav? Or we say, since he passed through a Makom Ptur, he should be Patur over here. Tosafot says, I don't understand the question. We've had this question already a number of times in the Masechta. We even had it in the first couple of daf of the Masechta. Someone is carrying out from the Chanut, from the store, which is a private domain, to the Rishut HaRabim, to the public domain, but he has to pass through the stav or the sitio. He has to pass through those areas that had the poles in them, the pillars in them, that was not classified as a Rishut HaRabim. It was classified as a Carmelit. Machloket, but there we concluded that he is Chayav. And we also had it before about Zarak. When you throw something and it passes through a domain, do you consider it as if it stopped or not? And we say that it's a continuum. So why is the Gemara, it seems to be the Zamoraim, asking a question that seems to be addressed numerous times by the Gemara? Rav Porat suggests the case here is a case where it lands on the pillar, not from his koach, not directly from his effort, but on a descent. So what happens is he throws the object, and then it descends onto this Rishut HaYachid. So the question is, if he had thrown it directly to the pole, no question that he'd be chayav, because that'd be from his power, his strength. It would have gone from Rishut HaRabim to Rishut HaYachid. The question here is if he throws it up high. When he throws it up high, his koach, his strength ends once the object reaches the top of its arc. As the object starts to descend now, then it's gravity that's taken over, and that's what we call koach kucho. It's a derivative of what he did. He threw it up, so therefore it has to come down. That's what the Gemara's question is over here, and that's how it's different than the questions that we've asked before. When we asked before, we asked about directly moving something with his koach, his strength, from one place to the other, passing through a makom that's not necessarily chayav. Here, it's a question about, not only did he move it from one location to the other, passing through this other location, but his koach, his efforts terminated inside of the makom tour, and now what takes over is gravity, or the fact that he threw it up, now is going to cause it to come down. In that case, that quasi-derivative activity, do we consider it to be chayav? That's the way Tosafot explains it. Now here you can see, it says bizarak, he threw it. There seems to be in the Gemara, there's no question, if you placed it on top, that you would be chayav. Amalei matnitani, said the Mishnah, ate shaila the Rav Yosef. He went and asked Rav Yosef the same question. Amalei matnitani, says it's a Mishnah. Ate shaila the Abaye, he went and asked Abaye. Amalei matnitani, it's a Mishnah. Amalo kuchu baroka dadade tafitu. You're all chewing on the same saliva. You're all from the same mold. You're all saying the same thing. Amrulei, they said back to him, atlo tisbro. You don't think that it's a Mishnah? That's not. We have the Mishnah. Here's the Mishnah. Hanotel mehen, venotein al gaban, chayav. Our Mishnah, that if you have a Rishut HaYachid, that is 10 tefachim high, in the Rishut HaRabim, if you take something from it, place it on it, or take it off of it, you are chayav. Now, what's interesting over here is that the Gemara is bringing a proof from something where you're placing it. The question was about zarak, throwing it. And now the Gemara brings a proof from placing something and taking it on, placing it off. So at this point, the Gemara seems to think that there's no difference between the two of them, and that's why the Gemara is using this Mishnah as a proof to that fact. Amalei, so now Rav Chista explains why he's not comfortable with that Mishnah. Dilma Nitan Bimachat. Maybe the Mishnah is talking about a case of a needle. So he could slip the needle from Rishut HaRabim to the Rishut HaYachid without passing through the Makom Ptur. Says, Machat Nami, Yev Shar Delo Madliya Purta. There's no way that the needle can get on top of the Rishut HaYachid without passing at least a minimum of a needle's length above the Rishut HaRabim, above 10 Tefachim, which is into that Makom Ptur. A needle, no matter how small it is, still has some space that it takes up. That space that it takes up, now you're going to move above the 10 Tefachim. So Gemara gives one answer is, de'itla mursha, that it has an extension out of it. This Rishut HaYachid is 4x4 and 10 high. On top of it is classified as a Rishut HaYachid. If it has an extension, something that protrudes out of it, if it's not too big, that protrusion out of it, it's what we call batel to the Rishut HaYachid. Consider it as part of the Rishut HaYachid. And even if it was below 10 Tefachim, that protrusion, it would still be classified as a Rishut HaYachid because it's considered to be an extension of the Rishut HaYachid that's there. Therefore, you could place the object onto this area, this little protrusion, out of the pole. The pole is 10 tefachim high, 4x4 wide. It is a Rishut HaYachid. The protrusion that's coming out of it, that's below 10 tefachim, is batel to the pole itself. And if you put an object on that protrusion, it would be considered as if you put it into a Rishut HaYachid. That's one possibility of explaining the Mishnah as not being a case where you exceed the 10 tefachim. The other possibility is that there is a paritz. There is some sort of slit or cut in it. So not that you have a flat surface on the top of 10 tefachim high, 4x4 wide. You have that 4x4 wide plate, but there is a chip on one of the sides. You cut in a groove on one of the sides. And that way you could then slide an object from the Reshut Rabim. Place your hand there. You could slide something onto the top without ever going through the Makom Tur. Because as soon as it reaches the 10 Tvachim, it's already on top of the pole area. So you have a way to access the Reshut Yachid without coming from above it. In order to be above 10 Tvachim, we have to assume that you got the object there by going above it. So the two answers of the Gemara is you don't need to get above it. Either there's a protrusion that's below the 10 Tvachim, or you have a groove or a cutout in the top of the pole that allows you to put the object on top without ever going above the 10 Tvachim. So our Mishnah is not approved because I can come up or I can create a case where it didn't exceed the 10 Tvachim, and therefore it does not answer my question. So Amar Rav Meisha, Boi Rabbi Yochanan. Meisha says Rabbi Yochanan queried this way. Potel Birshut HaRabim Gvoa Yud Ve'enu Rachav Arba. You have a wall in the Rishut HaRabim that is 10 Tvachim high, but doesn't meet the requisite for Tvachim wide to make it into a Rishut HaYachid. Mukaf LeKarmelit. It's surrounding something that is a Karmelit. Vasau Rishut HaYachid, and now he's making it into a Rishut HaYachid. Vizarak v'nach agabav, and he throws the object, and it lands on the wall itself. Mao, what do we say now? So the wall itself, if I looked at the wall independently, the wall itself is not a Rishut HaYachid. It's 10 Tvachim high, but it doesn't meet the requisite need for 4x4 Tvachim. Why? To make it into a Rishut HaYachid? Because it's narrower than 4 Tvachim. If it's narrower than 4 Tvachim, the wall itself is a Makom Pturu. In addition to that, it's surrounding a Karmelit. As the Reis says, the Mashma Dafka Mukaf the Karmelit. The wall now is being used to create a Rishut HaYachid. It surrounds an area that is 10 Tvachim high because the wall is 10 Tvachim high and more than 4x4 space. Rashi says, for instance, Kol Tozei Kifo Bigashi Haita Karmelit. Surrounding the Karmelit, vayado nasit reshut yachid, and now he makes it into a reshut yachid. So kohen shukaf ledira, put the wall around there to use it for living space. Oloi kifobo elabates that time. It's surrounded a space that less than two set, which would make it possible to make it into reshut yachid, even if it wasn't a living space. So you're taking an area that was once a Karmelit, now you're making it into a reshut yachid. Right. So that's the question here. There are both two possibilities of what it is. If either originally there's a Karmelit, and now the wall is surrounding this area to make that area into a Rishut HaYachid. That's one way to read the Gemara. The way to read the Gemara is that the wall itself is the Karmelit, and now the wall itself is going around an area that it's making into a Rishut HaYachid. What the area was beforehand doesn't really matter. Right, so you see Tosafot saying that it's Dafka Mukaf the Karmelit. The area was a Karmelit, and that's why Rashi just screamed over here. Kivu Bika Shaita Karmelit. He's surrounding an area that was once a Karmelit, now he's making it into a Rishut HaYachid. That's one way to read it. The other one is to say the area in between, we don't know what it was beforehand. Karmelit is the wall itself. Okay, wall. Oh, that's the question of the Gemara here. Mi Amrina and Kaven Deinu Rachav Dalet Zarach Nach Agabav. You threw an object now that lands on top of the wall. Mau. Mi Amrina and Kaven Deinu Rachav Dalet. Since the wall itself is not 4 Tvachim wide, Makom Pturu, it's considered to be a Makom Ptur, or Duma. Kaven Daso Rishut HaYachid. Since the wall is surrounding the area that it made into Rishut HaYachid, Gamad Damali Damya. It's as if you filled in the whole area. So the wall itself is surrounding an area that's Rishut HaYachid. Rishut HaYachid, around it now has walls that are 10 Tvachim high, and it's an area that's more than 4x4 Tvachim wide. So the area inside of the walls is considered to be a Rishut HaYachid. The question is the walls themselves. How do we view the walls? Do the walls simply create a Rishut HaYachid inside of them, but they themselves are not affected by it? Or do we say that if the walls create a Rishut HaYachid on the inside, we look as if the inside is completely full? If the inside was filled in, for instance, you put up the walls and then you filled it up with dirt until it was level, then the walls for sure would be a Rishut HaYachid, because then the span would be more than 4x4 Tvachim and it would be 10 Tvachim high. So how do we look at this? Do the walls themselves become a part of the Rishut HaYachid and now the walls are Rishut HaYachid? Or do you say, no, they remain separate? The walls themselves remain a Makom Tur. And what they're surrounding is what they make into a Rishut HaYachid. If you throw something onto the walls themselves, then the walls themselves have a Makom Tur because they don't have the requisite space on top of them. So Amar Ula, Kal V'chomer. It's a logical argument. L'achirim oseh, mechitza l'atzmo lo koshken. For others it makes into a Rishut HaYachid, it should be able to handle itself. If it can generate a Rishut HaYachid for other areas, then it certainly should make itself into a Rishut HaYachid. Itmar Nami, we have a similar statement amongst the Amoraim. Amar Rabbi Chiya bar Ashi, Amar Rav. Chen Amar Vitzchak, Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Kotel b'Rishut HaRabim Gvoa Yud. You have a wall that's in the Rishut HaRabim that's 10 Tvachim high. Veinu Rachav Arba, and it's not 4 Tvachim wide. Umukaf the Karmelit. and it was surrounding an area that was a Carmelite. And then he creates a Rishut Yachid in the middle. Hazarek v'nachal gabav. If you throw something, an object that lands on the wall itself, chayav. Acharim osem mechitza. Let's smog lo kosh again. First you're chayav, because if you can make the area inside of it into a Rishut Yachid, then certainly it can generate a Rishut Yachid for it itself. Bari Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan now queried. Bor tisha. You have a bor Rishut Rabim that is 9 tefachim deep. Vakarmi menu chulia. You take now, dig out another tefach, and you place that dirt on top. Vishlimu l'asara. And now you make it 10 tefachim high. Mahu. What's the din? So let's think about this. The dirt that you dig out on the inside, or the dirt on the inside that you're taking to make it 10 tefachim high, is an object that you're carrying now from the Rishut Rabim and placing it into the Rishut Yachid. Because until this point in time, it wasn't considered to be a Rishut Yachid because you didn't have the requisite 10 tefachim. When you place the dirt around to create the Chulya, you've now got it to the 10 tefachim high space. So now it becomes a Rishut Yachid. But at the moment you place the dirt down, you create the Rishut Yachid. What is the story with the dirt that you place down? Is that dirt as if you took it from somewhere else and now placed it into Rishut Yachid? Because it's going to become the wall of the Rishut Yachid now. Can you generate simultaneously a mechitza or a reshut, a yachid, and be chayav for generating it, because the object you place down is now considered as if you placed it into a reshut yachid. So when you generate the reshut yachid and place the object down to do that, can you also be held culpable for placing the object down into the reshut yachid? That's Rabbi Yochanan's question. You have a boar that's down 9 tefachim deep, and you take out and place dirt around it to make it 10 tefachim. What's the din? Akirat chifetz v'siyat mechitza ba'hadei hadadi ga'atu. They come simultaneously. You're mechayiv and you're chayav. Or lo, mechayiv, maybe it's not chayav. V'im timtzalom, if you want to save and came to lo, havi mechitza asara mikara. Since there wasn't a 10 tefachim mechitza there in the beginning, lo mechayiv, bor yud. What happens if you have a 10 tefachim deep bor? So that is a reshut yachid. V'natanu tuchach huya, and then you take out some of the wall around it, you dump dirt back into it, umi'ata. And now you remove it from being 10 tefachim high. Some of the dirt that you take around the edge, you knock off a part of the wall, and now it's only going to be 9 tefachim high. So when it falls into the bor, it lands in an area that's no longer classified as a Rishut Yachid. But the declassification of a Rishut Yachid happens simultaneous with the dirt landing in the bor. Until this point, the bor was 10 tefachim deep. When you put the new dirt in there, you're actually diminishing the space that's there down to 9 tefachim. It's no longer going to be a Rishut Yachid anymore. But that happens because of what you dropped in there. So simultaneous with the dirt dropping in there and landing in the Rishut Yachid, it's mivato, the Rishut Yachid. So before, Rabbi Yochanan was asking the question, when you generate a Rishut Yachid simultaneous with the object going down, can you be held culpable for that object? That was his first question. The Gemara says, okay, let's assume that in that case, you are not chayav. I'll ask you a different case, which is if you somehow diminish a Rishut Yachid, you put dirt in there, and you take it from 10 down to 9, simultaneous with the dirt landing in the Rishut Yachid, it's mivatel, the Rishut. So is that considered as if you put the dirt into the Rishut Yachid? Or since it's ruining the Rishut Yachid, it's no longer Rishut Yachid when it lands there. Can you have that happen simultaneously? Do we say that the landing of the object and the destruction of the Rishut Yachid happens simultaneously, and therefore you are chayav, and you're culpable? Or do we say no, since you ruined the Rishut Yachid, it's no longer Rishut Yachid when it lands there? Let him answer it from his own statement. Tanan, we had a Mishnah. Hazarek arba mot bikotel. Somebody throws an object in Rishut Rabim and it throws it right at the wall. The lemalam yasara, if it's thrown at the wall above 10 tefachim and it sticks above 10 tefachim, because hazarek ba'avir. It's as if he threw it in the air and you don't have a problem because it's above 10 tefachim. It's not being ba'avir dalet amot b'Rishut Rabim because you're throwing it, not carrying it. We saw that distinction before in the Mishnah that only when you carry something above 10 tefachim are you chayav, but if you throw something above 10 tefachim, you are not chayav. On the other hand, if he throws it against the wall below 10 tefachim, then he is zorek baretz, as if you're mavir dal amot b'Rishut Rabim v'chayav. Zorek baretz arba amot chayav. Vavinam ba v'alonach. It didn't land. You needed to land somewhere in order to be chayav. Where did it land? He threw it at the wall, and then it just fell down. Where is it landing that you're going to be chayav? V'amrav Yochanan medvela shmeina shanina. We're talking about sticky figs. These figs that were sticky, whipped them into the wall, and they stuck to the wall. They got plastered on the wall, and they don't come off. So that's how it was not. Vamai. Why do you have to say that? How can my eight mi arba amot? You're now diminishing the arba amot. Now, wait, Rashi learns the Gemara. The Mishnah later on in the Masechta says he threw a dalet amot and it sticks to the wall. The Mishnah doesn't say he threw 5 amot, 6 amot, how far away he is from the wall. It's time for the Mishnah, even if he threw exactly 4 amot at the wall. And when he throws exactly 4 amot at the wall, the fig sticks to the wall, it protrudes out of the wall, and it diminishes the 4 amot. So if it diminishes the 4 amot, here's your answer. You're chayav, even though it diminished the 4 amot. That's an answer to your question, Rabbi Yochanan. You made a statement about the village Shmina. That should answer your question. That's the way Rashi learns it. On the other hand, Tosafot does not like that explanation. And he says, near the reed, the Mari Al-Khasharak chutz the 4 amot. He threw it more than 4 amot. And this is the question. How come I eat me dalad amot? Once the fig sticks to the wall, then what happens if you throw an object that lands on top of that dvela? Is that considered to be part of the arba amot in Rishut Rabim? You have this dvela stick to the wall, and then you throw a pebble, you throw a needle that lands on top of it. When it lands on top of it, is that counted towards the arba amot of the Rishut Rabim or not? And the answer is yes. We say that whatever lands on top of it is part of the Rishut Rabim, and you're held culpable. So you see from that, that it does not diminish the Rishut Rabim. When you have an object that's there, that's stuck to the wall, it doesn't diminish the Rishut Rabim. So too over here, Rabbi Yochanan, the answer to your question should be that when an object is thrown in, it doesn't diminish the Rishut that was there already. Right, afterwards it may not be a Rishut, but when it lands there, there was a Rishut, and the object that lands cannot be the item that diminishes the Rishut. You'll be held culpable for it because it happens simultaneously. The Gemara says the cases are different. The cases are different because Hatam lo mevatale. Over there, he's not going to nullify it. It's not considered to be part and parcel of the wall. It's still considered to be separate from the wall. He's not going to leave it as part of the wall. Since he's not going to leave it as part of the wall, it doesn't diminish the airspace, the 4 amot that you have there. Because it's not considered to be one with the wall. It's considered to be a separate object from the wall. If it's a separate object from the wall, it doesn't diminish the 4 amot. Or the way Tosafot's learning, it's not part of the wall, it doesn't diminish from the Rishut Arabim. On the other hand, over here, when he throws the dirt into the boar, he's not going to take that out again. He's reducing the size of the boar. And he's mevatel it. He ruins the boar by doing that. He's going to leave it there. It becomes part and parcel of the ground. He's destroyed the area. What we have, the conclusion of the Gemara here is that we don't have a proof from that Mishnah over there. And we still have our question. When you simultaneously throw an object and it ruins a mechitza, it ruins an airspace, is that considered to be chayav or not chayav? We didn't answer either of the two questions posed by Rabbi Yochanan. The only one we possibly have an answer for is Imtim Salomar. Since by the case where you created the mechitza at the same time as the chavetz landing, the Gemara said Imtim Salomar, if you want to say over there he's not chayav. So sometimes when the Gemara says, if you want to say, that's a quasi-conclusion of the Gemara. So over there you can say maybe they concluded. Rabbi Rava. Rava queried, Zarak Daf, he threw a board, V'nacha Gabe Yitzedot, and it landed on these pillars or uprights in the Rishut Rabim. The uprights themselves were not big enough to be considered a Rishut Yachid. The board is 4x4 wide. So what ends up happening is when the board lands on these pillars or these uprights in the Rishut Rabim, it creates a Rishut Yachid above it. Because now you have the requisite 4x4 from the board, and you have the height from the pillars or these stakes that are in the Rishut Rabim. So together, once they combine together, they create a Rishut Yachid. Mo, what's the din? Mer says, what's his question? Nachat chefes, v'asiyat mechitzav hadei adad igatu. He's asking a question, which is, when the board lands there, it creates a Rishut Yachid. If it creates a Rishut Yachid, is he held culpable for the board? Because the board itself he threw from the Rishut Rabim, and it lands. When it lands, it generates a Rishut Yachid. So is he chayab? Because he generated a Rishut Yachid, and then the object landed at the same moment. So he moved the object into the Rishut Yachid. That was Rabbi Yochanan's question. Why is Rava asking the same question that Rabbi Yochanan asked? That's nothing different here. Why is he's just rephrasing the question? It doesn't make sense. So Kika Mavai the Rava, what's Rava's question? Now Rashi says, when we say Kika Mavai the Rava, says, Im Tim Salomar. It means the Gemara here says, if you want to say that Rabbi Yochanan, that Chefetz, Yasiyat Chamechitzaba, Dayadadi Lo Mechayev. If you want to say that the time that when you have an object that lands, and the making of a chitz at the same time is not Chayav. So again, that's similar to what we said before. The Gemara said before, Im Tim Salomar. If we think by Rabbi Yochanan that when they happen simultaneously, that is not considered to be Mechitza, I'm going to give you a different question. And this is how they rephrase Rava's question. Kagon Dezerak Daf, V'chevetz Al-Gabav. He threw the board, but there was something riding on top of the board. There was a pan, there was a bottle, there was a ball on top of this board. And now the board lands on these pillars or stakes. My, Kevin Dibadei Adodikaltu, Kanachat Chefetz V'tziat Mechitza Adami. Do we say, since whatever's riding on top of the board is going to land the same time as the board, so it's similar to the question that Rabbi Yochanan asked, which is, when you generate a Mechitza, you generate a Rishut, and object is landing it simultaneously, that is not chayav. And so too over here, even though they're two separate objects, since it's happening simultaneously, you're not chayav. Ojoma, It's impossible for the two objects to fly through the air and not separate a little bit. They're not stuck together. They're not joined in any way. And therefore, when you tossed and you threw the board and the object was on top of it, even if they separated a hair's breadth, that means that hair's breadth allows the mechitza to land, the board to land, create the mechitza before the object lands on top of it. And therefore, you should be chayav. It's the equivalent of making the chitza, only afterwards placing the chavitz down. That, the Gemara leaves as a teiku, as an unresolved issue. Amar Rava, pshitali, Rava says, it's simple to me or clear to me, that mayim al gabi mayim, hainu hanachatan. If you have water that lands on top of water, that is considered to be landing. So since it's considered to be landing, if you take the water out, then you are considered to be culpable. And if you throw water in, you also be culpable. So it'll be an akira or an acha of water. It goes al gabi mayim. You throw a nut onto the water. That is nut. Lav hainu hanachatan. That's not considered to be landing. When the nut lands in the water, it bobs around, it floats around. It really hasn't landed, it's moving. Water is always in motion. So since water is always in motion, therefore when the object lands in it, it's not considered as if it landed, because it's moving around still. If you throw water in there, or you take water out, water to itself is considered to be landing. But if you have a separate object that's landing there, like the egos, that's not considered as if it's landed. The question I have is, egos bikli. Bikli tzaf agabe mayim mahu. You have the nut inside of a utensil, and now the utensil is floating on top of the water. What's the din here? So it depends which object you look at. If you look at the nut, as far as the nut's concerned, it's landed inside a kli. It's in a good landing place. It found a good place to land, and it's landed. It won't move from there. Or do we look at the kli? The utensil that it's in is floating on the water. So that's what Gemara says. Me, I'm reading butter egos as lina. Do we look at the nut? V'hanayich, and the nut landed. Odilma butter kli as in, or do we look at the utensil? Follow naich, and that didn't land because the kli is floating along in the water. It's like the equivalent of the nut that lands directly in the water. It hasn't landed. So the Gemara leaves that as a tegu, an unresolved issue. Okay, we'll stop over here.